You're probably aware of printed works of ancient wisdom that you've never read. Maybe at some point you asked someone what the Tao Te Ching was and got gently corrected to pronounce it Tao Te Ching. However it is pronounced, it represents thinking from thousands of years ago about how to conduct mind and life, and it is presented anew in a book from Ashland-based White Cloud Press. The book is called In Harmony with the Tao, A Guided Journey into the Tao Te Ching. Francis Pring Mill is the author and our tour guide. Francis takes pride in taking fields of knowledge that present some difficulty in comprehension and helping other people make insights. He's had works published in zoology, software, engineering, and methodology, and he's our guest on The Exchange. Hi, Francis.
Hello there. Hi, Jeff.
It's good to have you here. Two questions to start. We'll start with the easy one first. Why is it pronounced Tao Te Ching?
Oh, my goodness. That's an easy question. I'm not sure. It's clearly the letter T in English, but it seems to be pronounced more like a D. I'm afraid I can't give you an easy answer to that question, but Tao Te Ching is kind of how you hear it pronounced most of the time.
Okay, let's move on to the harder question then, which is what is the Tao Te Ching?
Okay, the Tao Te Ching, it's a Chinese text, as you mentioned in your intro. It is ancient. It's over 2,500 years old. And it's really all about how to live in harmony with the world around us. That's in a nutshell what it is.
Is it compatible with other spiritual beliefs and practices or exclusive of those? I mean, is it the kind of thing that, you know, you have to be devoted just to the Tao Te Ching itself? Or
No, it's definitely compatible. It's about looking for the big picture in terms of which many of the differences that we tend to get so hung up on disappear because you've backed up far enough to see the really big pictures.
Is it something you've built up to, deciphering the Tao?
That's a good question. It's something I've been fascinated with for a long time, since being a teenager, actually, because it's a very concise book. It's got 81 chapters, which sounds like a big number, but they're very short. Some of them are only a few sentences long. And I've been fascinated by it for a long time because parts of it are very dense and cryptic, and it's not obvious what's going on. Other parts are more easygoing, but it's just something I've spent time with and said to myself, one day I'm going to take some time to explore why this thing resonates so deeply with me. And so now I've taken the time, obviously, since having grown up from being a teenager, to explore what's in there, and the book In Harmony with the Tao is the result.
Was the determination to get to this point, did it come from that first moment, your first exposure to the Tao as a teenager?
That's a great question. I guess I do recall the first moment because I came across a copy of it in a secondhand bookstore on a lunch break from high school, and I remember reading it and almost feeling like somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, you want to know what life's really all about? This is what's going on. And I went, this is an amazing book, and I remember reading it, and then you put it down for a few years, you pick it up, you put it down, and I guess I just got to a point in my life where I said, I'm going to take some time to find out why this thing resonates and what the messages are in there so I can see them more clearly. And then it kind of developed into a bit more of a project and go, well, hey, I wonder if I can help anyone else see it more clearly. Let's see if I can put this into a shareable version. And that's really behind how the book came to be written.
And Francis, I understand you stood upon someone else's shoulders in putting this book out. Tell us about Stephen Mitchell's contribution.
Absolutely. No, thank you for pointing that out. There are many versions of the Tao Te Ching. It's been translated into English hundreds of times, I think something like over 250 times into Western languages. And there are many versions out there. Many are quite scholarly, academic, and brilliant in their own way. But what Stephen Mitchell did back in the 80s was he created an interpretation, a version of it, which made it more approachable to the modern mind, to a non-academic audience. And in the various versions that I read, because after I got going on the first one that I came across, I've discovered there were other versions. So you start reading the other versions. And I kept coming back to Stephen Mitchell's. And that's really the one that resonated the most with me. And he kindly gave me permission to embed all of his version of the Tao Te Ching inside of my book. And so the pattern goes, for each of the 81 chapters, there's the Tao Te Ching, Stephen Mitchell's version, followed by what I call a guided journey into what's going on between the lines. And there's the next chapter, and then the guided journey. And so it repeats 81 times. But it absolutely could not have been written without Stephen's version. And I'm very grateful to him and HarperCollins for being on side with the whole project.
Well, you mentioned that there's some reading between the lines, and to give an example, I just flipped open to chapter 17. There's 11 lines of what Stephen Mitchell put down, followed by 2 pages of interpretation from you.
So which chapter are you on?
Chapter 17.
Chapter 17. That's a good example in terms of how concise the actual text is, because it's very packed. Just glancing to see what's actually on 17. Can you remind me of
page 53? This is when the master governs. The people are hardly aware that he exists.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yes, the people are hardly aware that he exists. So it's a very short chapter. I guess the reason why there are more words about what goes on between the lines is because it's paradoxical. Like, how can you govern and people actually not be aware of the fact that you exist? And what are they trying to get at there? And I guess that's really what I'm trying to explore, because in that particular case, it's all about how governing is effectively, as it were, or in the best ways, about getting yourself out of the picture, that it's not all about you and being the governor and being seen as a great man.
All right, getting this self out is a huge part of this book. We'll get much more into this with Francis Pringmill when we return from a break. The book is called In Harmony with the Tao, A Guided Journey into the Tao Te Ching. Francis Pringmill, our guest. You, our listeners, you can join the conversation when we return in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Francis Pringmill, who is delivering 2,500-year-old wisdom to us anew in a book called In Harmony with the Tao, A Guided Journey into the Tao Te Ching. This is, in fact, from China, from more than 2 millennia ago, 2.5, in fact, and he has taken the text of Stephen Mitchell's translation from the 1980s and placed his between-the-lines reading alongside that. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we explore the Tao Te Ching and Francis's efforts to make what can be a fairly dense and inscrutable sort of text and turn it into something useful for people on a daily basis. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Francis, was there any trepidation in trying to find meaning between the lines in a work this big and this momentous?
Oh, yes. That's a very good question, and indeed there was. It's a kind of a bold step to take an exploration into what's going on between the lines, that something's been around for such a long time and is so well known. So, yes, I do have to say there was a fair bit of trepidation. But for me, the way I got over it was I wrote it, quite honestly, at least initially, for myself. I was just curious. I wanted to know. And for me, the way I find out what I know is to write down words until I kind of click into focus, and then I go, oh, well, that's nice. Okay, I guess I can see it more clearly now, which was the goal. But then when it comes to, like, shall I share this with other people, that's kind of where the trepidation comes in. And I think if I'd started out by saying, I'm going to write a book for other people, I would probably have scared myself into silence. It started out as, I just want to see it more clearly, and that's really the origin.
Well, speaking of origins, I did want to ask you, we always want to give credit to the original author. Do we know who originally set the Tao Te Ching, who put it onto paper, or at least put it in whatever form it was originally in?
Good question. Yes, it's most frequently attributed to a man called Lao Tzu. Having said that, there is, of course, especially among the academics, quite a bit of controversy as to whether it was actually him, or it might have been somebody else, or some academics think it's a compilation of the writings of several different authors. But most frequently, you'll find reference to this fellow Lao Tzu, who wrote it down about 2,500 years ago. And although I understand the interest in was it really him or was it other people, I think the most interesting part is, what is it? What's on the lines? And how can you make a chapter out of 11 sentences, like you say? And what's the messages that are in there?
And I wonder about the structure as well. I mean, when we talk about 81 chapters, was there some numerological reason that we know, 3 to the 4th power or something?
I don't believe there was. No, I'm not sure why it's 81 and not any other number. I do know that when one first mentions there's a book with 81 chapters, you kind of think it's going to be 2 inches thick.
Right.
And then you discover, oh, what he means by chapter is 11 lines. That should be easy. And then you start climbing into it and you go, well, actually, I understand this bit, but wait a minute, that actually contradicts what was just said a few lines ago. And that's where the puzzle and the intrigue and the interest lies.
Well, and in fact, doesn't that really encourage people to make the interpretations? I mean, there are some basic principles laid out, but with the contradictions in here, there's almost a sense of like, hey, figure it out for yourself.
To some degree, that's true. I think a great image is like, well, actually, there's a fabulous quote. There's a quote about journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And in many ways, reading the Tao Te Ching is like taking a journey, I always feel, up a mountain with awesome views and insights along the way. The trouble is that parts of that journey up there, the path is windy and steep because the text gets so dense and cryptic. And even in some parts, you feel like it takes you to a cliff edge and leaves you hanging because you get these contradictions. So what's interesting is to look at what's between the lines, because I feel if you do that, you find what I call common threads that weave through all 81 chapters. And thankfully, they're not 81 of them. It's only a handful. And when you follow those, it's like they take you on a path of least resistance up the mountain to the finest views. And so that's really what it's about. What I hope to do in the book is say, hey, why don't you and me go up the mountain? Like, just trust me, let's go up this way, and let's see if we can see what Lao Tzu's pointing at. And I believe that when we get those aha moments where, like, you come around a corner and you just see a view of something that you haven't seen before, and you kind of go, oh, I get it. Now, what that means to you and what you do with it, that's very personal. But the aha, I get it, is kind of what I'm trying to do in the book, because I felt I had an opportunity to get up there, as it were, alongside Lao Tzu and hopefully see what he was looking at. And I'm just excited to point at it with other people and say, hey, can you see this too? Isn't it awesome?
Francis Pring Mill is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is In Harmony with the Tao, A Guided Journey into the Tao Te Ching. So to one of the basic points you make in the preface to the book, the Tao and desire, are they mutually exclusive?
In a word, yes. Most of the trouble, as it were, or the confusion and sorrow, as the Tao Te Ching mentions, comes from us spending way too much time in our thoughts and desires and our particular ideas as to how the world should arrange itself to suit what we think it should be. And the more we can let go of our thoughts and desires, that's not to say we drop out and do nothing, but the more we can just back off of our version of what it should all be, the more you do dwell in the Tao, as it were, and in that bigger picture of which you're not standing on center stage all the time.
So is there any good desire? And I ask this specifically because you identified chapter one as
yes.
Our desire to know keeps us in the dark. But
yes.
I mean, desiring more knowledge is not necessarily a bad thing, is it?
No, it's not necessarily a bad thing. And you can certainly, as it were, have desires and goals. They're not all bad. The trouble is when they run away with us. And there's a great chapter that starts in the pursuit of knowledge. Every day something is added. In the practice of the Tao, every day something is dropped. The trouble with pursuing knowledge, as you say, is that we can let it run away with us. And to some degree, there's nothing bad with that because they're good applications. We can do all kinds of cool stuff. But I think the trouble begins when we confuse what we know with everything there is and believe that knowledge alone should guide all our actions. And that's when we start to get into trouble and think we can kind of force fit everything into this structure of knowledge of which we're generally so proud.
So, when you get to things like knowledge is an illusion, I mean, it makes me ask if the apparent contradictions in the Tao are deliberate.
That's a great observation. In fact, some people have said it is kind of set up that way because the mind struggles, doesn't it, to try and make sense out of things like that. And I think as you do that struggle and you realize, well, actually, maybe thinking isn't the way to see what's going on here. And when, as it were, your mind finally falls silent, and contradictions are a great way of silencing your mind, you go, okay, what is there now? And maybe what you do is listen and be aware rather than grope for the nearest body of knowledge and a bunch of facts that whatever it is you're looking at should fit into and trying to fit it in.
You know, I didn't even think about this consciously until this moment, but I just realized that I was assuming that there's some level mind calming practice that helps you absorb the Tao, and I wondered if that's something that you do or you recommend for other people if they're going to try to take this on.
Personally, I don't think there is any particular mind calming practice that I practice. I know there are things like that work very well for other people, and to some degree, whatever works for you is what you should do. I find actually just letting the words roll around in my mind until I can let them go and see out the other side, or maybe look at some of the views that Lao Tzu takes us on the journey. That to me is the mind calming part, where you go around a corner and you just see something, and you then there's a phrase, immerse yourself in the wonder of the Tao. I know that sounds very passive, but when you can get to that place, then a lot of the things that seem to complicate our world fade away, and you can see a bigger picture in terms of which you can act to make a difference. But it doesn't originate with you. It originates with being centered in something much, much bigger than you. And when you can act from that place, as opposed to from inside your head and your own thoughts and desires, then much more harmony results, and you spend less time living in confusion and sorrow that I referred to earlier.
Chapter 2, Francis, really got my attention about making distinctions, that identifying easy creates difficult, and so
yeah.
On. This is a really, really profound concept.
Yes, it is. It is. And I think when it talks about distinctions in Chapter 2, what happens is that, well, one of the common threads that I referred to earlier is that the Tao Te Ching suggests that the way knowledge works is by separating things into parts and then naming them. And we get very good at doing this. And the thing is, as soon as you identify something out of, if you like, out of the great oneness, wholeness that is everything, as soon as you pick on any one thing and give it a name, then the not version of that suddenly exists, which is why it says, when people see some things as beautiful, other things become ugly. Like the concept of beautiful calls for the opposite of it to come into being, as it were. When people see some things as good, then other things become bad. And now we get into labeling. And then as soon as we start labeling, it's not a short step before we start judging. And we think some things are better than others, or we desire some things and not others, or we judge other people by what it is that they pursue or avoid. And it all starts to get complicated. And that's why the previous chapter, where it actually starts by saying, the Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao, the name that can be named is not the eternal name. Like, none of our labels are eternally real, as it were. They're all based on separating things and naming them, and then chasing the bits and getting lost among the bits if we're not careful.
We're talking to Francis Pring Mill about his book, In Harmony with the Tao, A Guided Journey into the Tao Te Ching. It takes a 1980s translation of the Tao Te Ching from 2,500 years ago by Stephen Mitchell and puts Francis Pring Mill's interpretations alongside. So sometimes there's six lines of the Tao and about two pages of interpretation from Francis, who sees quite a bit between the lines here. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. We're at jx@jeffnet.org. Carter in Wolf Creek is on the phone. Welcome to the exchange.
Yes, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, fine.
Okay.
Yes, I
was having a little trouble when I checked in first. The thing I would like to bring up in the conversation here is about the Te part of the Tao. And that is power, and it's two kinds of power. One is nurturing power, and the other one is domination power. And whether we like it or not, human beings on a life path have to live with that too. And the Tao repeatedly warns about keeping these two in balance. And that is one big challenge of life. The Tao part of it, to me, is something like the microwave background radiation of the universe, except there's no name to it. And it will not be named, but it's something that's subtle, and it's something that's pervasive, and it's something that most people that come to recognize that for what it is, have a great respect for its subtle power to support being just being. And two books I would like to mention here for the listeners, and I look forward to the author's your guest's book seeing it for the first time, is Ursula K. Le Guin, Oregon's own famous science fiction writer. She wrote her version of the Tao after observing her great father, Alfred Kroeber, the anthropologist, reading a version of it when she was a teenager. And the other is that personally, I consider the Wing Sit Chan version of the Tao to be very incisive, and it's been certainly very helpful for me. There's many other things I could say, but we'll stop the words there.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Carter. Any thoughts on what Carter was referring to earlier about the power and the Tay?
Yes, indeed. I think he picks up on a couple of really good points. It is absolutely about balance and about that bigger picture. And when he talked about the background, as it were, to everything that you can't name, I think that's absolutely on the ball. It is that oneness, wholeness of everything that's so big that you can't name it, because the minute you name it, you try and split it out from the things that you just didn't name. There's a great quote that says, that refers to, for lack of a better name, we call it the Tao, which kind of captures it perfectly, because you can't distinguish it. The best you can do is point at it and then hope people follow where you're pointing and just see it without the words. Referring to the other two versions of the Tao Te Ching that that Carter just mentioned, absolutely there are other versions out there. I'm familiar with Ursula Le Guin's version, which is a personal poetic one, and is very beautiful in its own way. And there are other, maybe more definitive or other versions of the text. I'd say the text to go with is the one that resonates the best with you. The only reason Stephen Mitchell's is in there, apart from the fact that I think he sold over 1 million copies of it out there, so there are many folks for whom it resonates really well. And it's a question of finding the one that just sings to you, and which, whether it's Ursula's or somebody else's, that's fine. It's all about the views and what you can see.
Are some of the views different from the interpretations you came up with here, I wonder?
They might well be. I guess in the end, it's quite a personal thing. And whatever you read and whatever you see is what the text means to you. And if another version of the text helps you see better, then that's the one you should go with, because it's not about one version being right or wrong or definitive or the only explanation. It's more about following the spirit of where Lao Tzu went and realizing just that there's a much bigger thing going on here that doesn't have you at center stage. And when you can align with that and live in harmony with that, then the best in you comes out, and you realize you can shape the flow, guide events as they unfold, not necessarily climb in there and try and interfere and control all the details and have it be your way. It's about exactly that balance, which is something that Carter referred to just then.
So, Francis, I wanted to ask about Chapter 3, which you labeled Desire Causes Confusion, and it raises the question whether the Tao simply does not deal with or acknowledge the material world, and secondarily then, but don't we have to live in one?
Excellent question. Yes, we do. We do have to live in one, and I think that's actually the constant challenge of our life. It's very real. You don't show up at the airport on time and the plane will leave without you. So we do have to organize ourselves and live in the real world. Dwelling is a very practical matter. You can't just detach and hope it'll all work out. I think what the Tao Te Ching tries to do, I shouldn't say it doesn't try to do anything. What you can see better as a result of looking through it and spending time with it is where in that everyday world you can act to make a difference that, like I was saying, is in harmony with what's unfolding, rather than you just trying to dominate the world and get your version of it to be what happens. And so if you can let go of that, that's really where, and that refers back to what you said earlier about desire. If you can let go of that particular desire, wanting to see particular results from your actions, that's when the harmony, and there's less of the confusion and sorrow that you're referring to here in chapter 3.
All right, so not to force your will in the world, but to let things come to you. This is just part of what we're learning in the book, In Harmony with the Tao, A Guided Journey into the Tao Te Ching, which is a work of Francis Pring Mill, following the original translation from the 1980s by Stephen Mitchell. We'll come back and talk more with Francis about his book and take phone calls and emails from you when we're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley, and we are getting a crash course in the Tao Te Ching, the ancient text from 2,500 years ago, generally attributed to Lao Tzu, but there's a fair amount of discussion about that. Our guest, Francis Pring Mill, took a translation by Stephen Mitchell from the 1980s of the Tao Te Ching and paired it with his own interpretations of what he sees between the lines. So in some cases, there are 6 lines of the original Tao and 2 pages of interpretation from Francis Pring Mill. His book is called In Harmony with the Tao, A Guided Journey into the Tao Te Ching. You can join us at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about the idea of not forcing your will upon the world and taking things as they come. And there's a great set of lines in here about do your work, then let go. And as translated here, one of the terms is keep sharpening your knife and it will blunt, which is some real insight.
Yes, it is. It is. The theme of do your work, then let go, or do then step back, as it says in some other places, I think is a very profound one, because most of the time we see actions as a means to an end, and we want particular results to come out of our actions, and often where we want people to associate the wonderful results we produced with us, and we absolutely don't let go. We want the details to turn out the way we want, and we hover all over it, and we kind of try to micromanage the details. And I think the message, or one of the messages in the book, is that if you just do your work in harmony, guiding and shaping the flow, and then stop, just back off and let it be what it's going to be, and detach, if you like, from your particular idea as to what the results are, that's when you live in the flow, as it were, rather than trying to paddle upstream and have everything be your version of what you'd want it to be. But letting go is very difficult because we tend to hold on. We cling. It refers elsewhere to clinging to your work and wanting people to associate it with you, and that's absolutely not where it's at.
And we've already mentioned about this is something that moves a bit apart from the material world. Obviously, we have to live in a material world, but this is also about getting ourselves out of the way. And I guess the major question becomes, how do we do that?
That's a very good question, because the self is quite a noisy critter, and we tend to listen to it a lot. And one of the best ways to do it is there's a chapter where he refers to being like the forces of nature and getting yourself away from the material world. And I'm just glancing, actually, in chapter 23, he says, express yourself completely, then keep quiet. Be like the forces of nature. When it blows, there is only wind. When it rains, there is only rain. When the clouds pass, the sun shines through. So the key word there is only, like just do your work, then let go, then stop, let it become part of the flow. Listen and respond rather than dominate and control, if I can contrast it that way.
And it does say in here, trust your natural responses. A little later on in a separate chapter of the Tao, there comes the nudge to trust our inner vision, which in that case sounds like trusting ourselves.
It does sound like that. It does sound like that. Inner vision, though, is something which is referred to as something you should try to cleanse of all thoughts. And just simply, there's a quote that says, do you have the patience to wait till your mud settles and the water is clear? Mud being a reference to the amount of thoughts that we have in the otherwise clear water that is so muddy that we can't see clearly through it. And if we can let that inner vision become clear And then there's a quote that mentions the master doesn't act. His actions flow from the core of his being. In other words, you somehow bypass thought and bypass the self that's interested in particular outcomes from what you do. And you just act from that deeper place, that inner vision, if you like, your true inner self, as opposed to the self-image or ego that's usually there trying to puff itself up in some form or other.
I wonder if this is meant to be an instinctual or almost more basic animal-like self. Is it ever said that explicitly by the original text?
The phrase animal-like doesn't really come up there, but he does make many references, and don't get me wrong here with the word animal, to children or to being like a little child who is much more spontaneous and acts in the flow of life. And in fact, if you watch any child, they're not there busy evaluating what should they do and what's their agenda and where are they trying to get to. When they're happy, you know it. When they're not, they cry. It's pretty simple. And in many ways, what we're encouraged to do is to return to the simplicity of that childlike state, not in the sense of being simplistic about it, but seeing the wisdom in the child who hasn't yet been complicated by life and acting from that place, a more spontaneous place, if you like, but still acting with sufficient adultness to know what compassion looks like and meeting the world where it's coming from rather than from where you are. But certainly simpler and with an inner vision that is clearer and preferably empty of all thoughts and desires, but still in the natural flow of the bigger picture.
We have another phone call here. Let's go to Al in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Francis Pring Mill, the author of In Harmony with the Tao.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask your guest, I have come across places where they're doing this presentation of the I Ching, and one where you would throw coins and the other one where you touch computer keys. And I think the idea is to keep a question or something in your mind and then or your heart, and then you're supposed to get the answer. I would like to know if you can speak for that. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thank you. I think we're hearing I Ching in here. That's not the same thing as Tao Te Ching, is it?
No, it's not.
All right.
Can you summarize the question again?
Well, he was asking about certain practices and the throwing coins, which is what made me think that this
right.
is the I Ching and not Tao Te Ching.
That is a different text.
Mm-hmm.
That is a different text. Yes.
So there are no physical practices then with the Tao Te Ching.
No, no.
All right.
It's not physical practices. If anything, it's more of a mental practice. It's interesting, if you look at the Tao Te Ching as a whole, there aren't any commandments in it. There aren't any thou shalt and shalt nots or rules and regulations, but there's an awesome summary quite late on in the book. It's like people have got a little impatient with Lao Tzu maybe and said, like, come on, summarize it. What are you saying here? And he says, I have just three things to teach: simplicity, patience, compassion. And if you had to summarize the book in three words, that would be it. Because elsewhere you get these references to the master teaches without words and performs without doing actions, which is very enigmatic. How can you teach without using words? But he's trying to get us on the other side. But when he comes back to our side for a minute and says, okay, if you really must have three words that summarize it, have these: simplicity, patience, compassion. That says it all. The rest is detail.
Which brings up a question emailed in from Jeff in Ashland, who wonders aloud, did your guest ever have a sense that writing an explanation of the work was in and of itself counter to its intention?
Sorry, counter to its intention?
Yes.
Oh, that's a good question. Hopefully not. I'd like to think that the purpose of the text is to help people reach their own insights. And for me personally, the way I tend to see things more clearly is to write. I kind of go into a quiet place and listen and write down what I hear and look at it and play with it until it kind of clicks into focus. And I go, oh, okay, that's what I see. So I don't think it was counter to any particular intention. Other people might just read the words exactly as they're written by Lao Tzu, and that works for them. And that's awesome. I guess I'm just sharing what happened to work for me. And if it works for other folks, well, that's great.
I'm really struck by, and I forget which chapter it is, somewhere around chapter 17, the idea of releasing from the concepts of bad and good, for example, that if you throw away morality and justice, people will do right.
Yes, that's quite a challenging thought, because it makes one think, well, really, will people just instinctively do the right thing? And there's an awful lot of evidence around us in the world that the answer is often no. But I think what he's trying to get at is that we need to not that we should fail to distinguish right from wrong, but as it were, we shouldn't get too hung up on the differences in the sense of having particular interpretations guide what we do. We should somehow back off to a bigger point where we act with compassion to make a difference in the world and let go of attachment to particular results that we personally want to see. So in that respect, I think he's trying to have us see that we can come at life from a different place and from a place where, well, like I've said before, where we're not at center stage and it's not all about us, because so much of the time we tend to approach the world from the view of our desires and the view of the way we want it to be and what we want to have and what we want to possess. And we think, well, I'll only be happy when enough people think well of me, or I've amassed enough material possessions, or this, this, and this. And the trouble with that is the answer is never. We never have enough of that. In fact, we're kind of missing the point. That's not where peace and harmony come from. That's not how we can make the contribution that we can to being in the world in the brief space of our little lives.
And there's a passage I didn't bother to write down in question form, but that's really stuck with me overnight, and that was the idea that when whoever wrote the text, Lao Tzu or whoever, was asked about, not particularly smiling, not particularly frowning, it was about the fact that my face reacts like a baby's face. I haven't learned things yet. Therefore, I don't respond emotionally. I just experience them. Which is a really interesting way to look at things.
Yes, it is. It is. You just experience, listen, and respond in whatever way is called for by the natural flow of what's around you. I think what he's getting at there is we often do react from emotion. We see something and we feel it's not in line with the way we want it to be, and we get angry about it or we get upset about it. That's often where the trouble starts. And I think you're absolutely right. It's a very interesting idea to pick up on.
We have another call here. Let's go to Steve in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Francis Pring Mill, the author of In Harmony with the Tao.
Howdy. I have heard from a couple people that Zen Buddhism has a lot of roots in the Tao. Could you expound on that?
All right, so Zen Buddhism and the Tao. Good question, Steve. Thanks for that.
Yes, they do have a lot in common. That's probably the short answer there. They do indeed. They have in common the ideas of emptying your mind to become aware of what simply is, and acting in harmony with the flow of what's around you, which is generally not what your chattering mind wants to have happen. So in that respect, yes, they do have a lot in common.
Another question here about the concept of light shows up over and over in the Tao. Embody the light, you say, which means what?
It's a beautiful image. I think for me, what embody the light means is that the Tao Te Ching says that many of the thoughts and desires that we tend to run our lives on basically block the radiance of the light that's within us, that the light that's everywhere. And when we can remove those, that's when the light shines. And their references to the master gets himself out of the way, and his radiance shines, and people can see themselves in him because he's not full of himself. Basically, when we're full of ourselves, we block the light. And that's exactly when the light doesn't shine and when the confusion and sorrow begin. So the idea of emptiness and light and capability springing from that emptiness is a very central. It's one of the common threads that run through the 81 chapters. If you can get yourself and all its desires out of the picture and not block the light, that's when it can shine through who you are, not the particular things that you do, because they just flow naturally from who you are and when you're aligned with the Tao and when you're dwelling in the Tao and in the big oneness, wholeness that is everything. That's when the light shines. And as it were, that's when it works the best. That's when you create the most harmony. It's like singing your song in harmony with the music all around you.
And you have ended at a very appropriate place, which is getting the self out of the way, which is such a common theme all through this this book. And it's been a pleasure to read it and to spend time with you. Francis Pring Mill is the author of In Harmony with the Tao, A Guided Journey into the Tao Te Ching. Thanks so much, Francis.